This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, this is The Screen Show. I'm Jason DeRosso. It is not every day that you get a behind-the-scenes documentary about a Prime Minister, and especially not one with footage shot by her husband. But that is the case in the new documentary about Jacinda Ardern, simply called Prime Minister. The film documents a tumultuous prime ministership. You may remember Ardern's personal life was transformed very early on by a pregnancy and subsequently by motherhood. And in the public sphere, there were catastrophic events beyond her control that she needed to face head on. Prime Minister is very much an authorised biography, you could say, but that's not to say it's not fascinating and at times insightful. The diaristic footage in particular illustrates the human dimension of politics and captures the emotional roller coaster behind national crises like the COVID pandemic and the mosque terrorist attack that shook the world. It's directed by Lindsay Utes and Michelle Walsh, and it's fresh from a festival run that began in Sundance. Prime Minister very much delivers a thesis that is Ardern's own, that there is another way to do politics and to lead. And this thesis runs counter to a lot of the authoritarian tendencies in the world today that have been resurgent. Jacinda Ardern is coming up.
I had the very best scientific advice, the best public health advice, great ministers, but it still sat squarely on me.
I'm going to go and have an early night. Be nice to see you sometime.
Yep.
Early start again in the morning.
Yeah.
I just need to focus on the evidence and the science and the modelling and the right thing to do. This is sitting between me and going to sleep now. This and you. So.
I have to compliment you on how you come out of this documentary, because I'm watching it, and apart from the fact that I've never done anything that required me to be sort of so sharp and focused and so responsible and so strong, that being said, I was watching it thinking lesser people would have been really grumpy. And overwhelmingly, I just get this impression of you as quite a cheerful person. And I'm wondering what impression you have watching yourself.
And yet that's such an interesting takeaway, Jason, because I have to concede that when I saw it, I remember thinking, oh gosh, I'm a bit surly there and I'm looking a bit irate there. And so I feel like you've just complimented me for being human, because that was my takeaway, was that is a very realistic portrayal of what it is to be a human in a hard job.
Tell me about how the project begins for you. I mean, did someone come to you suggesting this, or was it that your partner at the time, later your husband, was just filming and you thought, well, this could be the seed of something?
Yeah, it was pretty iterative. And I think that's the only way it could have ever existed, because I think if someone came and said, hey, you've got this new, very difficult job, how about we follow you around with a film crew? You know, absolutely not. But my husband is a broadcaster. That's his background. You know, he observed these moments and his mind was thinking, oh, this is pretty historic. Someone should capture this. And so that someone was him. We didn't have a conversation that said, hey, when this is done, should we do X, Y, and Z with this? It was more the case that in the back of his mind, he thought, if nothing else, I'll have a time capsule of our family.
And what is your impression watching it now? I mean, is it an out-of-body experience for you? Because it was such a capsule of time, obviously, as these kinds of moments in a politician's career are. I mean, it's the period of your prime ministership. And so there's obviously a definitive beginning, definitive end. Yeah. And so does that turn it into a capsule for you? And is that what this film represents? Do you see yourself in the third person almost?
It is a capsule. And I think watching it, my reaction to it was, that's exactly how it was. And that's how it felt. And so it felt very realistic to me. It felt like a very honest portrayal, which is a hard thing to do, you know, when you're trying to capture five relatively intense years in 90 minutes. I think the only thing that, and this is, you know, I think I don't know how you would have done this. The only thing is that it, as a result, doesn't have as many moments of joy that I recall. I've heard some people say they feel sad when they're finished watching it. And yet, when I concluded my time in office, I didn't feel sadness. That's the only thing that it's hard to put on a screen, is that on balance, emotion that you come away with might be slightly different.
Yeah, I mean, I think they do a good job at editing and actually delivering that final anecdote that you, you know, that you recount when you leave politics. And in fact, I think it's almost the day after you announce your resignation. There's a wonderful anecdote that I won't give away that I think is quite joyous and captures that sense of release that you feel. So that's interesting. I didn't have that impression at all that it was a sad film, but I did think incredibly stressful.
Yes, and that would be a very realistic portrayal. And I think people, you know, I think if you ever asked anyone, do you think, you know, the job of running a country would be stressful? People would say, oh, you know, absolutely. But I think it's something else again to put the imagery to it, to then also not just imagery that's a moment at an office with a stack of papers with some advisors around you, but what is it when you go home at night? And you're sitting on the floor of your home, surrounded by papers, knowing that you've got these momentous decisions to make the next day, and there's still bits of home life coming in and out. I think that's, for me, the reality of leadership. Yeah, I think it is probably a rare thing to have had that captured. So I am grateful to Clark, even though at the time of filming, I was not grateful. I was quite surly about it.
Yeah. I mean, but you're right. The images of you sitting cross-legged on a floor with a warm blanket or something, and just piles and piles of documents that you're reading. And at one point you're in bed reading, and you sort of point to a pile of manila folders and say, I've got to get through this before I go to sleep tonight. You do get that sense of that, I guess, conflation of the domestic space, but the work that just, you know, is all encompassing and takes over that space. And so that space is no longer domestic in some ways, you know.
And it's very easy, I think, probably in the aftermath of it all, I definitely took for granted the impact of that on my family, because you do become a little bit self-centered about the impact it's having on you personally, and perhaps you lose that perspective. And yet Clark used to talk all the time about there being three people in our relationship, or three things in our relationship, and the third was my briefcase. And that it followed us, and it did, but I didn't really think about every time the doorbell rang at 10 o'clock on a Friday night and that big suitcase arrived in a briefcase. I didn't really think about the fact that he would be often the first one to grab it, and he would hold it and get a sense of its weight to know how much time I would be spending with them that weekend.
Wow.
And there was something about seeing the film to bring in the impact on family a bit, yeah.
Well, your colleagues bake you a cake that is in the shape of a briefcase. So that illustrates how central it is to your life.
Well, they were the ones that used to fill it.
Yeah.
And so I think maybe there was a bit of guilt there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Look, what did you think watching Niamh? I mean, the other thing that's wonderful about your husband taking all this footage is that he's taking all this footage of your daughter, and there are a couple of shots of Niamh as a toddler walking around the lounge room, while on the telly there's Mum as the Prime Minister of New Zealand, coping with, you know, a series of catastrophic situations, quite frankly. What did you think watching that? Because obviously you weren't at home to see Niamh watch you on the television or sort of be exposed to Mum like that.
Like, used to take photos of her watching me on the TV. And actually Clark himself had his own television show at the time, Fish of the Day, which, you know, was him out fishing and then working with local chefs and talking about sustainability. And I used to photograph Niamh watching him. And so I knew that we obviously both had that practice. And unfortunately, it probably led to the first few years of Niamh's life, she was thinking that just everyone was on the television.
This is an incredibly meta childhood, I'm thinking.
And yet, I think, and this is not something I think that would be unusual to someone from either New Zealand or Australia, we're so desperate for her to have a normal childhood, the kind of childhood that you grow to appreciate in our part of the world. And so that's, you know, that's why we wouldn't make a fuss over Mum or Dad being on the TV. that's why she probably did, as I say, think that everyone was.
Speaking of that normalcy, any semblance of normalcy was well and truly shattered on that fateful day after that tragic and disgusting terrorist attack at the mosque. That was one of the moments that really marked your prime ministership and where many people judge you to have really risen to the terrible occasion as a leader. What did you think about the way the film handled that moment in your prime ministership? And I should say for listeners, it includes a moment where you're on camera being sort of interviewed about it and all the emotions seem to just well up again inside you.
Mm. And that's, you know, I think it's an accurate portrayal of how I feel about that particular time in the office. I think I'll never lose my sadness over it. I've said many times that it was probably the most humbling experience of my time in office, but also of my life, to have watched up close the Muslim community of New Zealand and the way they responded to a tragedy that was and a horrific act that ultimately they were at the center of. And so, you know, watching that part of the film, I had all of those emotions. I think they'll never go away. I don't think you get over some things in life, and certainly that's one that I won't. I'll carry that sadness for life.
People did really congratulate you about the way that you handled that situation, that terrible situation, and the leadership you showed. What are your own thoughts on that moment and how you reacted as a politician? How do you look back on it?
It's a sadness I feel over the fact that it was worthy of commentary, because I think at the time and with hindsight, I really felt like our response should have been the expectation that you would have of anyone in leadership. Here was a horrific act. If you are going to be an empathetic leader, then the center of everything that you do in the aftermath should be, how do I support those who are the victims and how do I prevent this ever happening again? And so the banning of military-style semi-automatic weapons, the work we did on radicalization and violent terrorism online, the support we tried to provide as much as we could to those who were amongst the victims, that should have been the minimum expectation of anyone. And the fact that in the aftermath, I still to this day have members of the Muslim community thank me for the response makes me feel deeply sad. They lost 51 members of their community and they're saying thanks. That just says to me how horrific their past experiences have been and their experience of Islamophobia as well.
Do you think it was a particularly crisis-ridden prime ministership? I mean, the documentary also is quite good at showing and reminding us all just of those crazy days at the beginning of the COVID pandemic. And then you had a significant backlash against you months into that pandemic, a lot of anti-vaxxers and various other groups that were sort of, that at one point rioted outside the parliament. I didn't realise it had gotten that heated. But
that was actually at the very end. It was at the beginning of 2022. And yeah. I think Pat, it wasn't in, maybe in people's minds because, you know, for the most part, we were at the end of COVID when that happened. We didn't have lockdowns anymore. We were opening back up. Omicron was moving through the country. We were a highly vaccinated population. And then suddenly we have this occupation of our parliamentary grounds. And so I do wonder if it didn't really stand out to people because of when it happened. It was in some ways an unusual period of time for when it happened. But yes, it did happen. And for many, many reasons, and I think it really has prompted this ongoing view in my mind that we have a globalization of political culture. We have a number of issues that are affecting all of us, mis- and disinformation, the impact of conspiracy, sometimes foreign interference. And that's not to say, of course, we don't have to take responsibility for those things that locally did play into that occupation, of course. But there are a number of other factors that I think will only resolve if we think about them carefully as a global community.
It's interesting seeing Hollywood now starting to come out with films that I think are trying to grapple with this political moment. And I'm talking about films like Eddington. I don't know if you've had a chance to see them or One Battle After Another. They're both films that I think in some ways are trying to grapple with extremism and ideology and violence. But would you agree it was a particularly sort of crisis-ridden prime ministership? I mean, I know that every prime minister seems to arrive in the job and within a few months the honeymoon's over, there's some major global crisis.
There's always something. There's always something. And you know, absolutely, we had a bit more of something than others. I think that's true. But, you know, also that doesn't stop. And that was something that was very gratifying about writing a book, because in amongst all of those moments in time, you know, a volcanic eruption, a pandemic, a domestic terror attack, and then a number of natural disasters, you're still doing things. You're still governing. You're still trying to progress all the reasons people elected you, because they elect you in spite of the things you'll have to manage in between times.
The film does mention that, doesn't it, as well? It gives you on screen those moments where you are pointing out, we've lifted the minimum wage, we've done abortion law reform. There are various things that you would expect of a Labor government to do within, and I think you did a lot of these things within those first 100 days.
We did. But it is true. I think what's really interesting is because the primary fixation for politicians when they're in campaign mode or when they're in opposition is all of the things that you intend to do, your agenda, your plan. And yet what's so often what defines us is what you cannot control. And that's leadership.
Do you think the hot seat would be even hotter now in the current sort of, from a global standpoint, being a leader of a country in the current moment, do you think it's worse now than, or more crisis ridden than how it was when you were?
I think politics is very, very difficult at this moment in time. I think it was certainly on an upward trajectory when I was in office, but I think it's more difficult now. And I remember having this conversation with Angela Merkel when she left, saying, how did you do 16 years? And she said, it was different when I started to the way it is now. And part of her definition of what made it different was, it used to be that when a problem presented itself, people would stand around, you know, in the office, talking about the issue they'd seen the night before on the evening news. She said, now we can't always necessarily even agree on the problem. And so I think that's a very accurate portrayal of where we are in politics now. It is a difficult space, definitely.
I want to speak briefly about, I think, one of the core things that the film has wanted to do, and this is, you know, from Michelle and Lindsay's point of view, the two directors, they wanted to make a film asking the question about what female leadership looks like. And in you, I think they found someone who articulates a very specific style of leadership, a very clear style of leadership, and this idea that you become a character in a documentary who's pregnant very early into your prime ministership, and you have a child during that prime ministership. So they're asking that question. Where does it end up landing, do you think, on this question of, are women different? Are they capable or naturally inclined to be different kinds of leaders?
You know, I think that in certain areas of work or occupation, particularly when people are familiar with those occupations, when they have a lot of public exposure, it's very easy to make a series of assumptions about how you have to be in order to succeed. And certainly if they're being dominated by particular genders, it's very easy to roll gender into that as well. But I think what we're perhaps not used to is certain character traits. And I don't think that we should have to necessarily define those by gender. But I do think that we've built a narrative around the idea that if you have a particular set of traits, then you won't necessarily survive or be successful or be strong enough. I really like the idea of disrupting that, of saying you can be empathetic, compassionate, and strong. In fact, politics is lacking that right now. And you do not have to be a woman to believe that those traits are important. I think I've said this many times. I think that the traits of a good human should be the traits of a good politician, and we shouldn't have to label gender around that.
Just finally, do you have any favourite political films, whether they're documentaries or just fictional depictions of politics or series, The West Wing? I'm wondering if you ever got into...
I did used to love The West Wing, that is true. In fact, I remember there's an episode where the president is depicted as grappling with whether or not he'll choose to run again. And he has a kind of a vision of his assistant who's passed away, who is pop quizzing him. And in the middle of it, she says, if you're thinking about not running because you're worried that you're going to lose, then I don't want to know you. And I watched it when I was grappling with the idea of whether or not I'd put myself forward for a contested seat. And I was afraid. I was afraid of making the leap. And I remember watching that episode and thinking, oh, God, I have to do it now. certainly there's certain shows that I've enjoyed over the years. That would be one. Sometimes I struggle to watch political shows if they're too realistic. It's just a bit triggering.
Yeah,
so I like
bet.
To feel a little more distant.
Yes. Did you like Yes Minister back in the day and those kinds of...
Dad used to watch Yes Minister. Yeah, and I remember at the time thinking, oh, how laughable. And then I went into the British public service and thought, oh, yeah, there it is. I really love the more recent depiction of Winston Churchill.
The Gary Oldman one? Or
yeah. I think it was probably because... you know, that appreciation of just what it is to lead and not to draw any comparison, of course, between COVID and a war of that nature, but just watching a leader in crisis, and also just the acting was incredible.
Jacinda Ardern, see her in the documentary Prime Minister in Australian cinemas. This is The Screen Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Jason DeRosso. The debut feature from my next guest won the Caligari Prize in the Forum section of the Berlin Film Festival. Now, the Forum, in the festival's own words, is a section that aims to expand the understanding of what film is, to test the boundaries of convention, and open up fresh perspectives to help grasp cinema and how it relates to the world in new ways. So, winning the award is really quite a high achievement. The film is called Fuens, that's Fuens with a W, and it's set over a weekend in Melbourne where two young women, friends, who haven't seen each other in a while, meet up to reconnect. And while catching up, they contend with some revelations about their lives that puts their friendship to the test. In your early 20s, you've usually gone through some tough moments. Perhaps they're the first tough moments you've ever experienced. And friendships often fall apart at this point. People grow apart. Sometimes, though, the friendships mature and people find ways to offer each other solace, comfort, and inspiration in the face of life's travails. Fuens is a film about a friendship that's growing deeper, but it doesn't come without a few hiccups. It's a low-budget film shot in long takes using a lot of zoom lenses that feels vibrant and inventive. It's anchored by two excellent performances from Emmanuel Matana and Melissa Gann. And it dips in and out of realism and segues gracefully through different tonal registers. There's small talk, there's deep dive conversations, there are heated arguments, and there's also joyous, nonsensical 3 a.m. babble when the girls are out on the town. I really liked this film, and as the jury in Berlin wrote, it's a cosmopolitan testimony to the fears and motivations of young women. I'd have to agree. It's also a trippy tribute to Melbourne. Director and co-writer Sophie Somerville is next.
Merry Christmas.
Okay, Santa.
Imagine if Santa came down your chimney and he was wearing this. Santa like comes to drop your presents off and he's just covered in blue scales.
Oh.
You're like, what?
All right.
And Santa's like, whoa, whoa, whoa.
I think if Santa's covered in blue scales, I think I'd invite him to the spa of Jesse as well, you know?
Yeah, his claws will get jealous. Be like, who's this lady with scales on her face?
I feel like...
his claw sounds like that too. Of course.
Yeah, but I'll be like, ma'am, I am doing you a favor. Your man could use a dermatologist.
What?
If he's covered in blue scales,
you're
you know?
Saying that Santa's got bad skin. He can't help it, man.
Why?
He's like hundreds of years old.
I mean, it doesn't help.
And he's overworked, goddammit. Santa's got millions of houses.
Well, he also lives in a really cold place. He needs to learn how to moisturize.
Sophie Somerville, welcome to The Screen Show.
Thanks for having me.
So tell me about how Friends develops. First of all, from a scripting point of view, is there a script when you're, or what does the script look like when you're about to shoot? How much is it improvised in front of the camera as you're shooting? Give me a sense of the dynamic of all of that.
So with Friends, because it was made by such a small team and me and some people that I knew really well and trusted, I felt really safe to kind of not sort of follow the rules of what a normal film makes you do, where you have a polished script and then it gets, you know, signed off on and then people jump on. It was very much like I had an idea and I wrote this very, very messy draft that was sort of a treatment. It was like 20 pages, 17 pages long or something. And then I sent it to Emmanuel and Melissa Gann and was like, look, here's the idea. Here's the like seed. And let's workshop it together and be shooting by this date. So the film never really had a written down script that was polished and clear and like sort of locked down. Like we were so loose in the way we made the film. So it was very kind of off the page for so much of it.
But it is quite a precise film though. At the same time, I think when you're watching it, it's got a very precise sort of structure and it all fits together quite well. It has a great sense of, I think, shape when it comes to the tensions. This is a film about a couple of friends who haven't seen each other for a bit, who are reuniting for this weekend. And there are moments of really happy, almost deliriously happy bonding. There are some very weird moments. There's some rancor, there's some anger that creeps into their interactions as well. It's a real roller coaster emotionally, but even visually, we've got this quite hallucinogenic middle section. But I think you've shot it beautifully well, and maybe we can start by talking a little bit more about this visual style so it gives people an idea. You've shot on the streets of Melbourne, essentially, in scenes that are mostly, correct me if I'm wrong, single take scenes, but there's a lot of reframing, a lot of use of zooms so that we're picking out details of urban scapes.
Carter and I fell in love with like super long zoom lenses on a short film that we made at film school because we just love the kind of 70s vibe, the sort of like the fun you can have with sort of, using the language of cinema in a way that is a bit different. And yeah, I think because of the limitations of this film, because we were so limited for time, we sort of constructed the film around being like, let's try and do most scenes in one shot. And then that limitation really forced us to think in super, super creative ways. And it was really, really fun to work with that limitation.
Right, walk me through some of the locations, because a lot of the locations are in the central business district of Melbourne, so really downtown. I think we begin at, is it Southern Cross Station?
Yeah.
Right. How difficult was it to shoot there? Is this guerrilla style? Did you have permits?
Basically, in Melbourne, there's a filming permit rule that says if you have a crew that's less than six people, it's considered ultra low impact, so you don't have to follow the kind of permit system. So that was what we worked around. We just had a super, super tiny crew. When you're shooting outside, there's just so much that can go wrong. There'll be like people doing silly, crazy, weird things in front of the camera and just unexpected events. So you sort of just plan for that. We would just, have to do lots and lots of takes if we needed to.
I was pretty amazed at how people walking by weren't looking into the camera. What sort of camera are you using? Is it a camera that just looks like a kind of consumer device that people wouldn't look twice at? Is that why there's not a lot of people looking down the lens?
Partly because I'm using the takes where people don't do that.
Okay. So there are a lot of takes where they do.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And then also, the camera that we used was like very much a cinema camera. Like it looked pretty chunky and big. But I think because we were such a small crew, it kind of maybe looked a bit broadcasty, like a bit old school news of a vibe. So people might have thought we were just making news segments or something.
And how many takes did you typically have to roll on for scenes?
It really varied because of the way the film was made and I was sort of editing in my head. Some things would be like take two would be like, that's the one. And then we'd move on and do the next one. And then sometimes it would be like take 15, 16, 17, being like, okay, we did it, but that thing happened, so let's do it again. And then this thing went wrong and that thing went wrong. And yeah.
I really love the sense of the city. And I like the long lenses because it, you know, a lot of these streetscapes, if it's in a wide lens, I find that it always looks slightly banal and not that interesting. But on a long lens, it crushes everything. And you've got the vertical sort of lines of street poles and you know, traffic lights and things like that that kind of dissect the frame. I don't know. It just starts to look aesthetically more pleasing somehow. And I think that really works for all these shots of alleyways, and Melbourne's famous for its alleyways. So there's a labyrinthine kind of, there's a sense of the city as labyrinth that works really well. But then you've got nature as well. Tell me about that and the role of nature and greenery. And it's a very lush kind of nature in the film.
Yeah. I mean, Melbourne is a super green city. Like, we've got some really, really nice green spaces. And I really there's a bit in the movie where they are walking through the city for like 20 minutes and then they finally end up in this rainforest. And it's like this feeling of like, oh, finally we found somewhere where we can like chill. I love the green spaces in Melbourne and I love to hang out in them. So I think we should look after them in our cities.
Tell me about the themes of the film. It's got a real sense of two young women who have really experienced some really not great moments in their recent past, in the last perhaps several years of their lives, or even less than that, in the last sort of couple of years. And they're both pretty bruised. And It seems to me that they're both in this point of their lives where they're wanting to take stock. And but I suppose each one isn't quite aware of what the other has been through recently. So this weekend is kind of catching up in that sense, but it's not that sort of cheerful, chirpy catching up. Part of it is, but a lot of it is catching up over kind of recent trauma. Tell me about what you were wanting to express.
Yeah, I think what I really wanted to convey was the sort of deep sense of instability and uncertainty that we feel in our 20s in this current moment in the world. There's so much pressure to, like, you know, have a house, and the climate change and mental health problems and loneliness and Em and Jesse are quite bruised. They're both people who are at low moments in their lives, and they sort of find each other and sort of cling to this idealized version of their friendship that they had when they were much younger, and when life was probably a lot simpler. And then throughout your 20s, things just get more and more complicated and you're more and more alone. And yeah, I just wanted to make something that expresses the importance of friendship and relationships, and how we just need to devote time to spending meaningful time with people, even if it's an imperfect relationship.
What about what you're wanting to convey about the trauma of surviving sexual assault? And I suppose this is a film that, even beyond sexual assault and sexual harassment, it's looking at themes of sexuality more broadly. I mean, that's one of the thematic threads running through this.
Yeah, I think when Emmanuel and I were working through that, what we really, really wanted to leave the film with was this feeling that she's not a victim and she's not wallowing in this sense of like, I'm hurt now. So we sort of wanted to sort of move her through this experience of being like, yeah, this happened, it was really fucked, I don't know what to do, and sort of moving through that to being like, yeah, but I'm a really clever person and I'm gonna keep on going and do what I love and not kind of let the world take my passion and my zest for life away from me. And I'm going to hold on to my innocence and my joy no matter what happens to me.
And yeah. Joy, I think joy and innocence are kind of quite make the film quite effervescent at times, I think. And I like the way visually this becomes quite an interesting film to look at. It kind of reminds me of, I mean, the film reminds me of some of the films being made by the French in the 70s, a film like Celine and Julie Go Boating, for example, the Revette film. But it's also got a Before Sunrise, Sunset, you know, all of those films, the Julie Delpy films and Ethan Hawke. It reminds me of those films also. Were they your influences amongst others?
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't like, this question about influences, to be honest, when I was making the film, I wasn't really thinking in terms of how it references other films. I was sort of just focusing on Em and Jesse and having fun with that story of those two characters. And then sort of after you've made a film, people are like, oh, were you influenced by this and that and this and that? And you're sort of like, I guess those films are similar, but I wasn't I think I was inspired in the way that the French New Wave filmmakers would kind of just refuse to let lack of resources stop them from making a film. And that was a real inspiration for me with this one, was to just be like, yeah, we don't have that much to work with, but we're still going to make a great film. Yeah.
Okay, well, tell me now about what happens when, I'm really curious to know, and I always ask filmmakers this, well, I usually do it when I remember in an interview like this, when they've had success with a film, and especially a first film like this, I'd love to know about what it felt like and what the experience was like for you. You take this film to the Berlinale, that's where it premieres, and then you win the Caligari Award there. Tell me about the reception that the film had.
Yeah, I mean, I was just in survival mode the whole time because I was so bewildered. Like, I was so confused. I was like, what? Why?
Was it surprising to you that it got in? Was that an easy process? Know people at Berlin, I guess, or did you just, was it just an anonymous submission and they called you back?
Yeah, it was. It was just us sending it through the online thing, and then they programmed the film. And I think partly because I had so much self-doubt, like I didn't know, because the film was made in such a small bubble, I didn't have a lot of professional kind of insight being like, oh, this is where this will sit in the world. So after I made it, it just felt like this very tender, raw piece of like arts and crafts that I was like, here you go. And so to see the world kind of embrace it really warmly was at first quite overwhelming, because it was like, oh, like, we can do more of this. We're allowed to do this more.
When did you first feel that embrace? When did you first think that, I mean, was it when you first saw it screened somewhere, or was it when you just got the first, when the Berlinale got back to you and said, we're programming it?
That was nice, but I think the first premiere where we played in this Art Deco cinema in Berlin that like Fritz Lang used to screen his films in the 20s, and I was just like so starstruck. I was like, what? There were all these very, very intelligent German cinephiles who just packed out the room, who were probably not the target audience of the film, but was so appreciative and kind, and and it just gave me so much confidence, because it made me realize that filmmaking is such a global language, and there's so much curiosity for films from everywhere.
Filmmaker Sophie Somerville. Her charming film Fuens is in very limited release in Sydney and Melbourne, and also showing at the Brisbane International Film Festival. Get along if you can. Hopefully more screens to follow. You're listening to The Screen Show on ABC Radio National with me, Jason DeRosso. Finally this week, to a documentary about a pair of Melbourne doctors, Marg Ross and Justin Dwyer, researching into the use of psychedelic drugs to help prepare terminally ill patients for death. In the film, they travel to Mexico to learn from the ancient shamanistic traditions of First Nations people, and this journey has a profound impact on them, both personally and professionally. The film is directed by Lynette Walworth, whose acclaimed work as a visual artist in virtual reality has frequently dealt with issues of First Nations spirituality as a way to question Western cultural assumptions. The resulting work here, which is called Edge of Life, is a thought-provoking, visually evocative and sensitive film about life's biggest questions. It releases next week, and there are also some Q&A screenings planned. Which makes sense. This is the kind of documentary that has a social impact dimension. It will be a conversation starter. The themes here of end-of-life care are relevant to most of us, whether in our own lives or in the lives of the people we love. Lynette Walworth is next.
We all know that we're going to die. Actually being told it is happening now brings up a lot of turmoil and despair. Our trial is using psychedelic-assisted therapy for patients who are terrified of dying.
I experienced my own death, and I felt a great sense of joy. Yeah.
I didn't see that one coming.
Psilocybin, ayahuasca, open the same door.
Almost every culture, to the indigenous people, it's core in their belief system. This is knowledge that we've lost.
I need to have my own experience so I can understand this better.
Booker. Justin.
Então tem a ciência e tem a espiritualidade.
It filled me with light.
It was another reality.
My God, my science doesn't have a language for that. So what do we do?
We are all interconnected, part of something infinitely larger.
Lynette Walworth, welcome to The Screen Show.
Thank you, Jason.
This is a film that does intersect, I think, with the concerns of so much of your VR work that I've seen in terms of the focus on Indigenous spirituality and so forth. But how did you find the starting point with this pair of doctors in Melbourne?
I read about them in the paper. There was an article that came out about this trial that Justin and Marg were doing to give large doses of psilocybin to a group of patients who were in palliative care in order to test whether it was helpful for people facing end of life. So I read about it. And to be honest, the first reason I talked to them was because I actually thought my VR worker, Wavana, could be of use to them. And that's why I reached out.
So in other words, this it could be of use because it does provide a sort of non-chemical psychedelic experience, I suppose. It's a very immersive experience. Because there, as you show in the film, their practice involves a kind of putting a patient into a sort of meditative state, I suppose, and invoking these sorts of psychedelic type experiences. And they, however, at that point hadn't been to Mexico. That was your connection?
So I thought two things. A Wavana, the VR work I'd done with the Yawanawa previously, showed a kind of tried to emulate or give a sensation of being in a strong altered state. We saw when people used that work in headset that if they'd previously had that sort of experience, it brought them back into it.
So if they previously had a psychedelic experience, it could trigger a psychedelic state or an experience again. Yeah.
Yeah. And so when I read and I knew about these trials because I'd been following them and interested in them for some time, and I knew that within the trials you can only ever give one or at maximum two experiences, so because it's very restricted. And I thought perhaps this work, which can help bring people back to the state, might be of use for them once they can no longer give any more of the medicine to their patients. They couldn't use it, of course, because a trial is so restricted in what it can do. But it began my conversations with them. And as you're pointing to, of course, as psychiatrists and psychologists in this country, they can't legally try these things that they're giving to people. It's not permissible.
Yes, only the patient can take this drug. The doctor can't, yes.
No, because at that time when we started, these medicines weren't legalized within the country. That changed during the course of filming. And what did emerge, and I understood this from filming them, was that they did not, you know, especially Justin, didn't have a great sense of what it was his patients were saying about the kind of extremely transformative and transcendent nature of what they were experiencing with what is called in this world a hero dose. So a dose large enough, let's say, to really transform your worldview. And in the course of this, then I said to them, look, you know, this is my relationship, as you pointed to, Jason, with Indigenous people who've kept these practices alive. And if you want, I can ask them if you could travel and actually have an experience for yourself.
Yeah. And then we see within the film, formally speaking, we see what resembles to me aspects of your VR work, if not actual portions of the VR work. I'm not sure you can tell me if you sort of recreated or created anew these sequences, but they were sequences in the VR work that are obviously, as you've said, quite powerful, where you transform the natural world into a visual representation of energy, really, the sort of energy or visions of energy that people who take psychedelics talk about during their experience. And so in some ways, the feeling is like we're flying through trees and amongst other natural artifacts, the material world, as if it was porous suddenly. And I guess to evoke an image in the listener's mind, it's as if everything's made up of luminous dots. That's one kind of aesthetic approach you take to representing this experience.
Yeah. You're right that I it comes initially from especially Awavana, where I took a portable LiDAR into the forest at that time, which was, you know, 2017 now. But this is all shot for this film. So that's not the work from Awavana, but it is captured volumetrically, which is what you're talking about.
Explain what that is, captured volumetrically.
So, you know, normally with a camera, and Bentley Dean, our wonderful cinematographer, would have his camera there, and you're kind of capturing something that's parallel. You've got sort of parallel screen capturing what is parallel in front of you. So you're capturing it at this one angle. A volumetric capture means I'm asking Bentley to go around this entire scene. If you're talking about a tree, you're taking that camera, you're walking around the entire tree with that camera. And you might do that several times in a sort of spiral. So it's like you're capturing all of this data about the tree from as many angles as you can. And then that allows us in post to pull all that data into a software program and to be able to sort of, if you can imagine how much data is there, decimate it into kind of points of light. But it does do that thing that you're talking about, which then you can move in and through.
Yes. And then, I mean, it's an effective, I think, visual metaphor for what becomes the spiritual dimension of this psychedelic experience. And I suppose what is also what points to the sort of therapeutic use of this experience, which is the patient begins to be able to grasp the immensity of death and kind of give it handles and understand it as just one sort of transitional experience within a broader experience that continues after death itself. Yeah. And this corresponds obviously to various spiritual traditions throughout history. And you point this out, you've got one woman who is one of the subjects of your documentary facing a terminal illness, and she has a very deep Christian set of beliefs, who also finds this new therapeutic approach to death very useful. So it's a fascinating documentary that I'm sure a lot of people get a lot out of it. How did you feel making it? Is it difficult to be so close to these themes and literally being so close to the people who are facing death?
No, I loved making it, Jason. It's probably closest to my worldview is what is being represented here. It's almost like a strange, like a coming out story for me, because these are my beliefs, I suppose. Or it's the way I see the world. It's closest to how I have understood reality. And to use the word porous, and I love that word, because actually I think that's what visually I was trying to show. It's also what these experiences of the mystical that someone like Roz, who you're talking about, had. For me, when I first met and interviewed Roz, it was an amazing thing, I'm going to say, because I think for her, she felt like she was talking to someone who knew what she had experienced.
Because of her Christian faith, do you think it really opened a door to her understanding what she already felt she believed?
No, I think because look, what she said about her Christian faith was that her whole life, like faith asks you to believe something, and her whole life she had believed. But this experience allowed, this medicine allowed her to experience what she had believed. And so it's a tangible difference, I'm going to say, about the direct experience of the mystical. And that direct experience was transformative for her, which you saw. It didn't shift her belief. It probably strengthened it, if anything. But it gave her, you know, those handles that you said to hold on to. She didn't just have to believe it. She had felt it and seen it. And for someone like me who doesn't have You know, I don't have a religious belief system that holds me, but I have had some of these experiences by accident and not through this medicine. And so we could talk about those experiences as two people who, if you like, had had that sensation of the porousness of reality. And for me and for Roz, it was affirming. And so the interesting thing is, in fact, apart from it being hard, it's like a blessing, because you're not alone in a strangeness of a Western worldview that tells us that unless that everything is materialistic and unless you can touch it and know it through your senses, it's not credible. And so it's a strangely joyful experience. And Roz and I did become very close and talked about these things a lot, whether in front of a camera or away from it.
You mentioned you'd had these experiences before in your life. Are you able, do you feel comfortable elaborating on how you had these experiences? Because you mentioned by accident as well.
Yeah, I had experience as an 11-year-old where I basically died and had to be resuscitated. And in that time, you know, it's a long time ago now, Jason. I mean, in that time, I had what we would call now probably a classic near-death experience, although at that time I don't think it was even written about or very much talked about. And certainly, and as an 11-year-old to go, I have had a sensation of something outside of my physical reality that feels, in the doctor speak, the kind of questions they would ask people, more real than real, unforgettable, not a dream, and which has never shifted. So now here I am decades later and can still say to you, I had this experience. Now, I had to then live in a world where no one I knew had a similar experience or could talk to me about that. So in some ways, I suppose that's what I'm saying. To meet Roz, who was, at the time I met her, still trying to find the frame in which to hold her experience, to talk to someone like me who'd had a similar experience through a different pathway, it was an affirmation. And we have the beautiful Bill Richards in our film, he's an expert on this. He had his first experience with psilocybin in the 60s in a trial in Germany.
Now, he's an academic, I think, at Harvard?
Johns Hopkins.
Johns Hopkins, yeah. And he's a psychologist or psychiatrist by trade.
I think he's a psychologist, yes. And he's probably one of the foremost people in this field because he's been in this field for so long. And he says, you know, you see, he gives Justin advice in this film about how to talk about this. And he says, we should say this experience is part of like human nature. You can access it via different means, but these medicines, and he lists the kinds of medicines, psilocybin being one, ayahuasca being another, are a reliable key.
Yeah. Well, look, it is a fascinating film. I know that you're doing Q&A screenings around the country, so I know that these issues and themes relating to end-of-life care are very important. We're all going to face these themes and issues in our personal lives at some point, I'm afraid. So, look, it's fascinating. Fascinating also to see the journey of the two researchers, the two doctors within the film, and the effect that the experience they have in Mexico has on them too. Lynette, it's been great speaking to you again.
You too, Jason. Thanks so much.
Lynette Walworth, Edge of Life is out in cinemas next week. Get along to a Q&A screening if you can. And that is it for another episode of The Screen Show. It's been great to have your company. Thanks as always to producer Sarah Corbett. I'm Jason DeRosso. We'll do it again soon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.